We're coming to you from WAMU 88.5 at American University. It's the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Namdi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Todd Turner, who is the chair of the Prince George's County Council. County Council. He represents District 4. Joining us now by phone is Will Smith. He's a Maryland state senator representing District 20, which is in Montgomery County. He's also the chair of the Judicial Proceedings Committee in the Senate, which is what we'll be talking to him in that capacity mostly about today. Senator Smith, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. Greetings from Annapolis.
Tom Sherwood, what's dominating a lot of conversations today is the coronavirus, which is not according to a CDC official, not a matter of if, it's a matter of when it comes here. And we know that there have been cases in Maryland, the District, and Virginia. What's each jurisdiction doing about this?
Well, each jurisdiction is making sure that the medical services, the hospitals, and other medical support are aware and prepared in case there is a significant outbreak. I wasn't very encouraged by the president's press conference yesterday. It felt more like a political campaign. But I was glad to see Anthony Fauci there from the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases for a national response. But, you know, it's hard to realize that just this came on our conscience just in late December, and it's already spread around the world. And I like the fact that the health officials are telling people, treat this as you're supposed to treat the flu. Wash your hands frequently, sneeze into your arm, be aware of getting around in public. It's a very serious matter. I know people who have canceled trips. I'm considering canceling a trip to California and other kinds of things.
Same here.
The problem is we don't know how bad it can be, and so maybe the senator has something more to say about it.
Well, there are no cases in Maryland, Virginia, and the district. People have been tested in all three jurisdictions, but no one so far has been contracted.
But there's no clear understanding of how it's being passed either. So there's a lot of the worst thing you can have, and that's why the stock market and others are reacting to partially about this, is the worst thing you can be is not know. So I would ask just people just pay attention to the health authorities and not political pundits.
Anything to say, Senator Smith, about this?
No, just say that the governor held a press conference yesterday on the matter, and I have to commend him for marshaling our resources and applying, you know, some additional resources federally and distributing them statewide for if this were to escalate. And here at the State House, the presiding officers have told us this exactly the same way. That folks are not symptomatic, so it's hard to tell. But just do the things you would do to prevent yourself from getting the flu. So wash your hands. Hand sanitizer has been distributed to all of our offices. And folks are just doing good general health practices. So I hope to commend the governor for his forward-looking approach to getting ahead of this. So,
and similar stuff has been said in Virginia and Maryland. You know, I started paying more attention when I realized in Japan, the government there has asked that the public school system close down for a month.
Indeed, we'll be keeping you abreast of developments in this region on that issue. On the political front, Tom Sherwood, next week is the Virginia presidential primary. Of course, the Maryland presidential primary doesn't come around until April 28th. But it's my understanding, Senator Smith, you already have a favorite candidate.
I do. I came out and endorsed Mayor Pete. I met him a few years ago at a national organization for young progressive leaders, and I was very impressed with his vision, and we both actually served in the same role or similar roles in Afghanistan. So I have an appreciation of his service to the nation and also to his community back home. So really impressed with him and proud to support him.
I'm sure he's going to have to do a lot of making up in Virginia if the polls are in any indication.
Well, do you agree with Mayor Pete that if the party nominates Bernie Sanders, that it will have negative impacts down the ballot with state Senate and House races, that it could be a disastrous decision, even if you like some of Bernie's policies, his doubling down on being a Democratic socialist could really play down the turnout for the Democrats?
No, I think there's something there. I mean, I think certainly Senator Sanders brings an energy to the race that we haven't seen before. And I think that can galvanize a lot of folks that maybe wouldn't have participated in the political process in years past to bring them out to the polls. But certainly in places like Virginia, where it's a little bit more purple than Maryland, you can certainly expect some of those consequences to ripple down. I don't think that's without the realm of possibility.
The important thing for Virginia voters is the Super Tuesday is on Tuesday, and Virginia is part of the 14 states and that are having elections that day. There is a new poll out from the
Wasson Center
at Christopher Newport. It shows that former Vice President Joe Biden is ahead at 22%, but that Sanders is close by at 17%, and Mike Bloomberg is at 13%. The other candidates are back in single digits. So be part of the big test. You know, Mike Bloomberg's coming into the state. Bernie Sanders was in Richmond yesterday. Elizabeth Warren has been there. Mayor Pete's been there. It's quite the time. Just don't forget to vote on Tuesday.
Our guest is Will Smith. He's a Maryland State Senator representing District 20 in Montgomery County. If you have questions or comments for Senator Smith, give us a call, 800-433-8850. Will Smith, Governor Larry Hogan called on you to step down from your position as the chairman of the Judicial Proceedings Committee since the committee has not passed a part of his crime legislation. Before we get into the governor's comments, let's talk about the legislation itself. It's my understanding that there is one bill in particular, the Violent Firearms Offender Act, that you take issue with. Why is that?
That's right. Well, so the governor had three, you know, bills in his package, and obviously senators have offered similar legislation to mirror each one of them. They differ slightly, but in the same general direction. The one sliver of the package that I took exception to was the piece that would have implemented six additional mandatory minimums and had several provisions in which there were some significant enhancements or penalties. And so the reason that I took such exception to them is because the governor, when he came, when his staff came to present the bills, didn't offer us any shred of information that implementation of new mandatory minimums would increase the security proposition in Baltimore City or our state. It harkens back to some of the failed policies that we've had in the last 30 or 40 years that have essentially taken generations of Marylanders and Americans off of a path of rehabilitation and out of society for a period of time that doesn't serve us well in terms of getting people back into the stream of society, getting the jobs that they need, getting the training that they need, getting them rehabilitated, essentially. And so now you have a situation in Baltimore City which we had record violence that we've ever seen, and less economic opportunity than we've ever seen. So it just didn't seem to me to be the sound way to approach the complicated problem of crime in Baltimore City and the state of Maryland.
Can we talk race for a second here? Because it would appear to me that your opposition to the mandatory minimums has a great deal to do with not only the fact that you mentioned that it hasn't had a great deal to do with rehabilitation, but it's also had, in the eyes of many people, a devastating effect on the African-American community.
That's absolutely right. So the first thing I did when I became chair was I arranged for a series of briefings to start us off at the session. And the first briefing I had highlighted a report by the Justice Policy Institute that showed that 70% of our prison population was African-American, and that we were actually the worst in the state with respect to racial disparities in our prison population than any other state, including Mississippi, which was the next closest. Now, no disrespect to Mississippi, but this is not the company you want to keep with respect to racial disparities in our criminal justice system. So it shows you that something is happening, that justice has not been fairly administered over the course of the last few decades, and mandatory minimums would only tilt that balance and have more severe impact on the discrepancies that we've already seen without yielding any real results. And so I took great exception to that. And frankly, I took exception to the fact that he called on me to resign because I wouldn't move that piece forward. But
Let me ask you, mandatory minimums makes stop and frisk look like child's play, given the impact on the African-American minority communities in general. Now, the governor called it disgraceful that you wouldn't move these things, but even the Baltimore Sun said what's more disgraceful is not the bills, but the fact that the governor has taken no affirmative action to work with the legislature. He hasn't appeared before the legislature committees. He hasn't had any conversations with the General Assembly leadership. Since that his call for you to resign, has he in any way reached out to you or to the leaders of the assembly to have a conversation as opposed to a spitball fight?
Not directly, no. I mean, the first thing I did was I invited him to come before our committee, and governors in the past have done so. Both Democrat and Republicans have come before respective committees to make their case. And one thing that I pointed out was that the governor has an unparalleled ability to convene folks from all across the nation, all across the state, to get the expertise and the background and knowledge that you need to develop good policy. One other thing is that he neglected to approach, Baltimore City is a council, 15-member council, a mayor. We have a delegation here in Annapolis from Baltimore City, the second largest in Annapolis. He didn't consult any member of the Baltimore City delegation.
Like the Senate president.
Correct. Including the Senate president, who's from Baltimore City. And so that was something that I thought was fundamentally flawed about the approach that he took when he went about crafting these pieces of legislation. Now, since all this has happened, I will say that we've had some communication with his staff. They've been remarkable, and they've been great to work with. And I think the thing that got lost in this exchange was that Democrats and Republicans on my committee have been working day and night over the course of the session to craft a comprehensive package of crime-fighting legislation, not only focused on sentencing and restructuring enhancements, but on witness intimidation, judicial transparency, police transparency, repeat violent gun offenders, ability for law enforcement to share intel and resources across the state and across the city, and legislation to address people that are on parole and probation and infuse new resources in certain areas of the city that are particularly crime-ridden. So we have a comprehensive approach that we'll be rolling out. We voted out a couple bills just this morning, and we're going to return back to our committee this afternoon to do more. But we've got a plan to roll things out over the course of the next couple weeks. So I thought that was what was missed in this entire exchange, was that we actually have been working in a bipartisan manner to move our state forward and to develop a comprehensive approach that addresses not only the immediate but the long-term contributors to violent crime in Baltimore City and the state of Maryland.
Well, you suggested that the government should provide data rather than depending on polls, but the polling numbers that the governor produced were very impressive and favorable to his bills. 85% of 600 Maryland surveyed support a proposal to increase tougher sentence for violent offenders who commit crimes with guns, and only 9% do not support it, and several of those people were polled in Baltimore. What do you say to them?
I say that the polls, you can't develop complex policy to solve complex problems based on overly simplistic polling. Now, and also, so that's one thing, because you missed the nuance on all of these things. And a lot of the solutions that were proffered will bear immediate political fruit, where you can go back to your jurisdiction and say, we jacked up a bunch of sentences, we've implemented new mandatory minimums, so we're going to arrest a bunch of people. And then you'll get a short bump in your polls, and it'll be popular. But it doesn't solve the problem at hand. And then second, I would say that as leaders, we are responsible for developing complex, nuanced solutions to problems. And sometimes that doesn't lend itself to polling. And so as a leader, you've got to start stepping up and sifting through the nuance and the details and get to the real root causes of crime rely on overly simplistic polling.
We've done mandatory sentencing. We've done private prisons. We've done all types of things to essentially criminalize people and lock them up as opposed to change the course. But there's another issue where the governor has really been aggressive in fussing at the General Assembly, and that's the Kerwin Commission's report on school funding, the billions of dollars that will be needed from the state and from local jurisdictions, like Montgomery County, where you're from, and Prince George's County in our area. And there's been a lot of pushback already on the idea of changing the sales tax system in the state to help get some of that money from or businesses that are not now taxed. When will we see some agreement on the legislature and get that passed?
Sure. Obviously, I don't sit on those committees, but
vote on it.
I do, absolutely. And the professional, there's even a bill that came to tax professional services in Maryland. So look, those committees are actually working, and we'll have a solution before us in the next week or two.
Is this another case of where the governor is not sitting down with the president of the Senate and the House and working on it and just firing shots from the side or above or wherever he is?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And too often, I think that the two branches of government are working in isolation. I have to commend the Speaker Jones and Senate President Ferguson for reaching out consistently. Publicly, Overture is asking to coordinate and collaborate with the governor. So look, this is something that's been, again, weeks, months in the works. It takes time when you get folks back in the legislature for 90 days to get together to hash out the final details. But I know that, and I've been in some of the leadership meetings where we're very close to having a refined package of revenue generators that don't touch sales, income, or sales or income tax. So, I mean, we'll see what happens in the next couple of weeks, but it's a process, and it is on its way.
Got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Will Smith. He's a Maryland state senator representing District 20 in Montgomery County. I'm Kojo Namdi.
This month at WAMU, we're lifting our voices to shine a light on Black changemakers throughout American history. Some you know and some you don't, but they all change the world. Hear the stories of these incredible scientists, activists, artists, and more throughout February on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at WAMU.org.
Welcome back to the Politics Hour. I'm Kojo Namdi. Our resident analyst is Tom Sherwood, contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with the chair of the Prince George's County Council, Todd Turner. Joining us now by phone is Will Smith. He's a Maryland state senator representing District 20 in Montgomery County. Senator Smith, Governor Hogan redesignated three of his crime bills as emergency legislation. What difference does that make?
So when you redesignate something as emergency legislation, becoming law in October, it becomes law as soon as the governor signs it. So he did that, I think, in part to ensure that his bills get the resources and the processes that he wants to get implemented immediately, and in part for theater, I suspect. But we've also done the same thing for our crime package. They're all designated as emergency bills so that the resources can start flowing and the legal changes that we're making can start immediately.
Does it require a bigger vote for emergency, or is it the same vote?
No, it's the same vote. Okay. It's something that the senators will consider.
Let me ask you about something that's not as weighty, but it's very dangerous in Maryland and elsewhere, and that's distracted driving.
Yes.
I'm sure people are listening to the program now and texting someone about, but there's a bill in the Senate Bill 819, that would allow local jurisdictions, police forces, to photograph people in vehicles who are using their phones illegally, would be illegal. There's all kinds of questions about what would people be photographing in phones. Make sure you're with your spouse and not somebody else. But distracted driving clearly is involved in so many with phones and so many wrecks, accidents, deaths. Where are you on that bill, or have I characterized it correctly?
You have characterized it correctly, and we had that hearing yesterday, and it was actually really heart-wrenching testimony with some of the folks that had actually. We had a woman that came in, and actually she had killed someone because she was distracted. And then, sitting next to her was someone that was rear-ended by someone that was distracted. So it was a very emotional day in our hearing. So the technology would essentially, allow the squad cars equipped with it to take photographs of people inside of their cars. And the first question that everyone has is the privacy concerns. And so I asked for an attorney general's letter to just kind of sift through some of those concerns. And obviously you have a diminished expectation of privacy when you're in public. And so it seems as though the technology would be fine with respect to that issue. Then there's a second piece of, where do the images go and how long are they kept and who keeps them? Can they be used to prosecute other crimes that may have been caught? So all those questions come up, and we're still sifting through that in the committee. Obviously, we just heard it yesterday, but it's a big issue, and the testimony that we received yesterday was very compelling.
Russell in Rockville, Maryland wants to talk guns. Russell, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. So what I wanted to say is, I'm originally from Texas, and but when I moved here, and I'm former military, so I've grown up with guns. I know how to handle guns. I know how to do them responsibly, and I know how to be a responsible citizen. So my question or my statement is that, I think what needs to be done is a lot of people making the laws for gun control, have no idea what to do with guns or how to shoot them or have ever even touched them. And a lot of people are anti-gun, have never done anything with them. Now,
Before we get any farther, we don't have a great deal of time left. What is your specific question or issue with Senator Smith?
So what my question is when you talk about mandatory sentences for all these people, I hope that you look at not punishing law-abiding citizens, which is what happens in Montgomery County.
Okay. I don't think law-abiding citizens are repeat gun crime offenders in the state of Maryland. So that was not what the senator was talking about. But Senator Smith, you are someone who is in favor of gun control, and I get the impression that our caller, Russell, doesn't like that.
No. Well, first, I'll say, Russell, thanks for your service in the military. But look, the gun legislation that we've had before us, in fact, we passed just this morning, we passed out of our committee closing the loophole on long gun sales for sales, private sales, and permanent transfers. But we didn't, choose to criminalize the temporary transfers or require those checks and temporary transfers, understanding and respecting the fact that hunters have to do what they need to do and that there are lots of situations like that. With respect to the legislation in Baltimore City, that focuses on regulated firearms and repeat gun offenders using regulated firearms. So, and in more cases than not, these folks are prohibited persons to begin with. So they're possessing the gun unlawfully, and then they go and commit a violent crime, not once, but twice or three times.
Tom Sherwood was telling me earlier today that D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser is going to be introducing legislation to ban ghost guns in the city.
Yes, here it's happening right now. The mayor's doing emergency legislation that would ban ghost guns. She says they cannot be traced.
Are guns that are manufactured using a variety of parts.
3D printers and just kind of put together.
And so they have no serial numbers.
Right. We had about three or four incidents where police gathered two or three of these guns or collected these guns or seized them. And this past year, there's more than 100, almost 120 guns of these types have been seized. So it's a growing menace in the city. What's it like in Maryland?
So it's a growing concern. I had legislation 3 years ago to ban 3D printed guns because they are a type of ghost gun, meaning that they're not serialized, they're never registered, and the technology is growing such that you can actually develop these guns or print these guns in your house, and they're operable for more than just one shot, and they're not detectable. We had a hearing in the Judicial Proceedings Committee, and then I know the House actually had a hearing yesterday on ghost guns, so that those bills are being heard and entertained in Maryland. I don't know the prospects of passage, though.
The Washington Post reported this week that federal immigration authorities have run facial recognition searches on millions of state residents in Maryland without seeking state or court permission. A spokesperson for Governor Hogan told the Post yesterday that he is opposed to cutting off ICE's access. What do you think of this issue and of the governor's response?
Well, I suspect it was in response to the circuit court decision that came out of New York City, yesterday. We had a bill hearing on that issue yesterday. Senator Lamb from Howard County proposed a bill to limit those access for ICE agents only. But when we dug into the issue a little bit more, we found that if you have NICS access, meaning you're a law enforcement official that has access to this federal database, you can access Maryland MVA data from wherever you are in the country. So a sheriff who has NICS access in Arizona can access your information here in Maryland for no reason at all. We don't have a way to trace it. There's no permission that's needed. They just simply log in and they have access to your facial, they have your picture and your address.
What's the fix?
And your name. So that should terrify every Marylander.
What's the fix?
The fix would be to require a warrant, a judicial warrant, to access that information. You put some sort of a firewall, and if you need to go in and search, then you have to have a warrant. So there's at least some sort of a judicial check on that. New York State implemented that, and that was one of the pieces of the challenge that went up in that circuit court case. I will say that the Third Circuit and the Seventh Circuit have gone the opposite way. So there is a split, and I suspect it'll come up to the Supreme Court in the next few years.
Here's Bob in Rockville, Maryland. Bob, your turn.
Yeah, hi. I was calling about the bill that Senator Kagan has for targeting drug driving.
Yes.
I'm concerned that would might disparately affect racial minorities who are more likely to get pulled over. my understanding of metabolite testing and even THC testing for cannabis is that it hasn't been able to accurately predict someone's impairment. So if people are being disproportionately pulled over and tested, they're going to be disproportionately affected and sometimes without cause.
Senator Smith.
Yes, so Senator Kagan from Montgomery County. Cheryl Kagan. Yes, her bill would have been would start a pilot program, and so this device would be officers would be limited, and certain jurisdictions these devices would be in the squad cars, and they'd test for drug driving as well. Now the test is not admissible in court and could not be used, but the concern that we had in the committee is that although it's not admissible in court. And although it's not proven technology yet, it's a pilot program, that a positive reading could influence the officer's decision to take someone in. And so that's what we're wrestling with. But I know it's been introduced a couple times before, and we're still working on it. So,
for your constituents in Montgomery County, the legislature has had a couple of bills, I'm not sure the status of them, that would allow jurisdictions to change and raise taxes locally. But also, we've had Robin Ficker has you don't have to laugh when I say his name.
It's okay. We're great friends.
Okay, that's well. He's persistent. He's turned in 16,000 signatures. He needs 10,000 to put a measure on the ballot in Montgomery County that would limit property tax increases to inflation. You're a Montgomery County resident. I don't know if you own a home or not. What is your thought about that bill hamstringing or keeping the government from spending too much money?
Well, I would initially, I know to allow us to go above our charter limit on that, but I initially would reject those types of initiatives because we elect our county council and our county executive for a reason to make good decisions on our behalf, and so that's certainly an issue that would come up during a campaign. But I would say never underestimate Mr. Ficker. I know he's nothing if not persistent, and he was successful in the term limit, his campaign to have term limits for county council. So he's shown a prowess for this type of activity, so I suspect he'll bring the same energy to this.
Don't have a lot of time left, but I want to get in Eileen in Rockville, Maryland, because this is an issue you're interested in. Eileen, go ahead, please. We don't have much time left.
Yes, my question is, what is the status of the Death with Dignity legislation in the Maryland session this year?
Senator
Any chances
Smith.
Of it passing?
Yes, so we're hearing the End of Life Option Act this afternoon in our committee. We have over 200 people signed up, so it'll be a long hearing. But as you remember, I was a sponsor of that legislation last year, and it didn't prevail on the floor. It died on the floor because we had a tie vote. And this year, we have another senator from Baltimore County that's moved over from the House. He initially voted against it in the House. So it looks like we're two votes shy on the Senate floor. We could definitely get it out of the Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee. I'm just not sure we could get it off of the floor. So we're working on it. So we're looking forward to a great hearing today. And it seriously relies just on two votes.
Yes, then it's appropriate to really say good afternoon, Senator.
And before we got to run quickly, you have to go over to the Bay Bridge a lot. I guess you do. Are we going to have that bridge ready for people this summer?
Oh, I hope so. It looks like it. It looks like it.
Okay. Will Smith is a Maryland State Senator representing District 20, which is in Montgomery County. Thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure to be here.
I'm Kojo Nandi. Welcome back to the Politics Hour with Tom Sherwood. Joining us in studio now is Todd Turner. He's the chair of the Prince George's County Council. He represents District 4. He's a Democrat. Chair Turner, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for bringing me back.
If you have questions or comments, praise or criticism for the Prince George's County Council Chairman, give us a call, 800-433-8850. Tom Sherwood, former Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh was sentenced to 3 years in prison and I think 3 years probation after that. She could have gotten as much as 15 years in prison, it is my understanding, for the Healthy Holly book scandal. Some would say the Healthy Holly book scam.
That's what it was. Yes, 3 years. She this was a long, drawn-out embarrassment, but it was all began with some stories in the Baltimore Sun. Give credit to local media if you're worried about this local media disappearing in your community. And the judge, you know, there were a lot of people in the state who sent letters in, political people sent letters in asking for leniency for her, that she'd been having trouble and she was 69.
Including
and all
former
of that.
Mayor Kurt Schmoke.
Yes, I didn't want to name any names. But the
was
judge,
on the paper.
But the judge said it was a blatant, it was a clear cut, it was a, for whatever reason, she went right to corruption, and she needs to be not only punished for it, but also to be an example to other elected officials that this cannot pass. And so she will be going to prison for 3 years.
She apologized profusely, and I don't know if that had any impact on her sentence.
Very few people who are convicted and standing in court refuse to apologize. But fortunately, there's a spirited now ongoing race for mayor in Baltimore. So people who are involved in Baltimore need to help decide somebody to win and to help bring that city out of the trouble it's been in.
You mentioned the importance of local media. Our guest, it is my understanding, really didn't like the fact that the Prince George's Sentinel went dark at the end of January. What does that loss of that publication mean for your county?
Yeah, it's another voice for the people of Prince George's County that we don't have anymore. With the closing of the Gazette newspapers several years ago, you know, we get some local coverage by other outlets as part of that, but it's not that kind of community paper anymore.
My friend Tracy Wilkins from Channel 4 is in Prince George's County, and then there's a Post reporter, I believe, but beyond that, that's about it.
I mean, we got some local papers, obviously, you know, in my area of the county. I represent both Bowie and Greenbelt, so we have local papers, although one is based out of Anne Arundel County, the other one is a local paper in Greenbelt.
Right.
So we get a little bit more coverage in my area, but in other parts of the county, that's another missing voice that we have, and so we're sorry to see it go after over 40
plus years. You've been reelected as chairman of the council, so congratulations.
Thank you.
Let's talk about education. Maryland's General Assembly is considering the multi-billion-dollar education reform Kerwin Commission proposes, and counties and cities will be required to cover part of the cost as it stands now. Prince George's County is estimated to pay $360 million more each year to education when the reform plan is fully implemented. Your county executive has expressed concerns about that proposal. Do you share those concerns?
We do. And let's be honest, you know, we're a partnership with the state of Maryland with respect to funding school education in Prince George's County. We understand our needs, particularly with our student population, both English as a second language, free and reduced meals. So we have, along with Baltimore City, probably the greatest need for additional funding. And so the Kerwin Commission has come out with its recommendations. We're having that discussion now in the General Assembly as they're considering how.
Are you working with the Prince George's County delegation?
Very much so. Actually, just last night, the subcommittees of the on the House side were considering amendments, particularly the leaders of the education subcommittees on the House side are two Prince George's delegates, Delegate Washington and Delegate Barnes, and they came forward with amendments last night that would reduce the amount over the 10-year phase-in of the what they're calling the blueprint for Maryland's future to reduce the amount by almost $200 million. So obviously those are amendments. They're going to be considered over the course of the next week or so.
Would that be enough?
Yes,
you would like more help, both you and the city of Baltimore, but is that enough?
Well, what will happen is, so the city and the county's requirements, and there are other jurisdictions that would be impacted as well, that just means the state will be ramping up its share. So we'll get the same amount of funds, as I understand it. We're still looking, you know, for the amendments.
Why doesn't the state simply pay more for it? I mean, it's a state proposal. It's a state mandating what you have to do or not do. Why doesn't the state simply just pay for it rather than put it on the local jurisdictions?
Well, you know, I don't.
It's one third on local jurisdictions, roughly.
Roughly, yes. The current formulas are in that way. Obviously, this current.
The governor says this is a hit on taxpayers. It's going to be too costly and not do anything for education.
He also says it's not a priority for Maryland.
Yeah, I don't necessarily agree with the governor on that. I mean, I think if you even look at the poll numbers, you know, everybody thinks education, although I saw a recent poll that education was maybe not the top concern in the state. I think crime was, if I remember correctly. But, you know, as a public school graduate myself, as well as a parent of one who graduated from Prince George's Public Schools and one who's currently in there, I understand firsthand the importance of public school education and having the opportunity to give everybody the same opportunity no matter where they live in the state of Maryland. So this is a partnership. We understand that. It is a state obligation under the state constitution.
Will it require Prince George's County to raise taxes to meet your obligations?
Depending if the amendments that are being proposed actually go forward, I don't think so. And I say it on this way. Over the last—
You hope not.
Yes, that's where— You know, the same way the state said they didn't want to raise taxes in order to do this, you know, we're asking for that same opportunity in Prince George's County. The issue then becomes we have gone above what we're required to do over the last 8 years in Prince George's County on school education, about $134 million over the last 8 years. So if we get in that range going forward in 10 years, given some of the economic things that are going on in Prince George's County, including our job creation, you know, hopefully we'll be able to afford that without having to do any tax.
We got an email from an anonymous listener who said, would you please ask Chairman Turner what the county council is doing to address response times for police and fire?
So it is an issue for us related to some parts of the county, particularly our what we would call more agricultural and rural parts of the county, the southern part of Prince George's County, because there's a larger geographic area as part of that. Police Chief Stawinski has come forward with some initial proposals about trying to rearrange how the districts are based in Prince George's County for police response as part of that process. We actually have legislation in place that will determine if we don't meet certain response times, there are certain requirements for any particular other development to be able to move forward, including—
What's the difficulty? In the District of Columbia, there's a growing complaint about the city's unified command center that is duplicating dispatches. There's delays in sending people. There's lots of— the response time for 911 is not good. Is it the use of cell phones and tracking? What is the issue? Is it just bad training of the people answering the calls?
No. So it's not related to the calls themselves. What's happening is the response by the police once they receive the call from 911. And so particularly in the southern part of the – because we only have two districts that are generally there, and they cover the largest geographic area. So actually getting from place to place is why you're not meeting
the response. Not a suggestion they're ignoring or not taking them seriously.
No. Actually, you know, I have to give credit to Police Chief Stawinski. You know, we've seen our crime numbers go down, as well as to County Executive Alsobrooks. And that's why we're able to focus on some of these other areas that we want to continue to improve in Prince George's County, including our education system, economic development, job creation as well.
In Prince George's County, executive council members and mayors are not allowed to receive campaign donations from developers. That came in the wake of former county executive Jack Johnson being sent to prison for accepting bribes from developers. Maryland Delegate Derek Davis is proposing two pieces of legislation in the General Assembly that would change that. One would lift the donation restriction in Prince George's County. The other would broaden the prohibition to cover county council members, mayors, and executives throughout the state. Where do you stand on that?
So I'm not sure that's the correct understanding. My understanding, there are two bills. One is a local bill that would take the county executive out of the restrictions that were initiated back in 2011, I believe. I believe there is a statewide bill. It's not my recollection that it included members of the county council as part of that. So we're, as county council members, we are under current law restricted from receiving direct donations.
Would you like that law changed?
Now, we've been able to deal with it for almost 10 years now as part of that process. I will say this issue is the issue is that it only applies to Prince George's County. It does not apply to any other jurisdiction in the state of Maryland. And so that is a fairness and equity issue. Some would argue, you know, there is a basis for doing that. And I know I've heard Delegate Davis say this as well with respect to his bill, is that the county executive is not directly involved in approval of land use items as compared to us as the county council.
The Prince George's got some really positive news not long ago, just recently, when you surpassed Montgomery County in the rate of new job creation and economic development. One of the biggest businesses in Prince George's County is the Washington NFL football team. Dan Snyder has been looking for a place to build a new stadium for the Skins. He still would be hopeful to be in D.C., some tentative hope in Virginia. But more recently, Post reports Richard McCarthy. I forgot his first name.
Bob McCarthy.
Robert, sorry. Wrote that, looks like now he may simply build it right at where FedEx Field is now, but he also wants to be able to do sports betting. Where are you and where is the council on this?
So on the, obviously we've had a long time relationship, obviously, with the football team in Prince George's County. We have a current lease that goes until at least 2027, doesn't preclude them from continuing as part of that. And so we would like to continue that relationship. I think we're excited about the opportunity, as it's been explained, with respect to just not just a football stadium, but an entertainment complex along the lines of what you've seen with other NFL teams as part of that. So that's an opportunity. Obviously, he already owns land around FedEx Field now. And so we're hopeful. I know he's advocating at the state level with respect to sports betting. The county council did take a position of support to include potential stadiums as an opportunity for sports betting. I'm not sure where the NFL is right now with respect to that, so that might be a factor. But we did support giving him the opportunity, along with casinos, racetracks that are being currently considered by the state.
Margarita in Laurel, Maryland, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Coach Jill. Thank you for taking my call. Councilmember Turner, I am a Prince George's County resident, and my call is in concern with the breed selective law, also known as the pit bull ban. So I'm wondering why we're still investing our taxpayer dollars, knowing all the needs that the county has, in keeping this ban, 23-year-old ban, that has proven to be effective. I would like to know why it's still being voted out in the council.
So last year, if you've been were following, we did an update to the animal control provisions in Prince George's County. We did consider and did pass out of the one of our committees to get rid of the breed-specific ban as part of that. That's the farthest that's gone over the 23 years that that breed ban has been in place. After further discussion by the entire council, that was not included in the ultimate legislation as part of that. I think part of it is just educating both the members of the council as well as the public. One of the things that occurred that we had a couple of attacks during the course of that consideration of the legislation. But what I'm hopeful, and I think what we got was a 21st century animal control provision. There are a lot of provisions in there that deal with other issues, but we continue to need to have that conversation about the breed ban. I personally supported getting rid of the ban as part of that, but we still have to work on that.
Do you have a dog? Colleagues.
I do not, actually. I'm actually allergic to dogs. So.
Okay. Here now is Bill in Greenbelt, Maryland. Bill, your turn.
Hi, all. Listen, Montgomery Council, T&E Committee, we felt aggrieved that it did have a Metro Compact public hearing on its capital operating budgets. It's having their own meeting on Monday night in Silver Spring. Marvin Goldman, who sits on the Washington Suburban Transit Commission, will be there, if not officiated.
What's this have to do with Prince George's County?
The WSTC have more than one
You're breaking up, Bill. You're going to have to call us back. Bill, you're breaking up. You're going to have to call us back on a better line because we really can't understand what you're saying.
It would be a good chance to talk about the purple line, though.
I will say, with respect to the WMATA budget, we did do a joint letter between County Executive Andrew Lossell-Brooks and the council. We just approved it this Tuesday in response to their proposed budget for the upcoming fiscal year, expressing concerns about some elimination of services. And
bus service particularly. I mean, yeah. I know people in the district and other places are.
That's what Bill wanted to talk about, bus service. Okay. Go ahead.
Yep. Lots of bus service. It seems it's everyone I speak to about this is – this is a time when bus service should be improved and made more accessible to people to get on the buses. Yes, there are probably some money-losing routes, but if the routes are not reliable, then people don't ride. Then you say you don't need it because people don't ride. Yes. Is this Metro just trying to hit us all over the head to get our attention on this?
I don't think so. I serve on the Washington Suburban Transit Commission as a representative of Prince George's County.
Mr. Wiedefeld, the general manager, is serious about this.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is we just went through something called the Bus Transformation Project that WMATA did and funded.
That's what Bill wanted to talk about.
So, we just went through this whole review and study about trying to improve bus lines and services as part of that. And so to come with the first budget after that, And we've talked about they passed the resolution, the WMATA board passed a resolution, I think back in January. We had a briefing on the bus transformation project earlier this month. So we're asking, let's try to implement that first before we go back and start cutting services.
Yeah, Mayor Bowser had a rally across the street from the headquarters of Metro, worried about late night bus service. Metro just seems we went through a couple of years of worry about Metro and what it's spending, and this new budget seems like there's going to be a lot of fights between now and May, I think it is, or March, whenever it's done. Yeah,
I will simply say this. Listen, I appreciate very much Paul Wiedenfeld. You know, for the first time in 40 years, we got a historic agreement on funding on the capital side for WMATA. Right. They put certain restrictions with respect to operating funds as part of that, you know, the 3% requirement. And so he's trying to fit that in, and that's why I think some of the proposals are out there. I don't think all the proposals are going to be passed as part of the budget, but I think it's worthy of a serious conversation about services.
Let me speak briefly about the Purple Line. I was online. I was looking at some pictures of some changes around College Park, some development there. The old City Hall was torn down this week, but there's a lot of development. There's a lot of street closing, and things are the Purple Line is happening.
Yeah, literally just yesterday in our Transportation Committee, which I serve on, we got an update from Purple Line Partners, transit partners, as well as from MDOT and MTA. And anybody who's traveled along that corridor has seen the work going on. The one thing that we're very excited about is that the Purple Line will open first in Prince George's County. It's scheduled to do that at the end of next year if everything goes as well. We'll see if that happens. But if you travel along that corridor, you are seeing the burdens of having this new opportunity for transit for Prince George's County. And as you indicated, the development that's occurring along the lines on both sides of Prince George's and Montgomery County is something that we're trying to deal with. And I know particularly with respect to potential housing and the impacts as part of that. I know we're trying to work on those issues as well.
Here is Ndale in Fort Washington. Ndale, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Kojo, thank you for the opportunity. I have a question about the Indian Shade Highway road project. It has been going on almost close to 10 years, if I'm not exaggerating it. No progress, I don't see any, and then the road is very, very ruggedy and bumpy. It cost us our
We don't have a lot of time left, Ndale, but I'm assuming you want to know when is this going to end and the road is going to be smoother to travel again.
That was Indian Head Highway?
Indian Head Highway. Yep. So obviously it's a state road, so Prince George's County doesn't directly control. We have been very supportive in doing improvements, including dealing with issues related to fatalities along the road. We've been able to get additional assistance from the state for speed cameras, working with our state delegation. It is going to be a multi-year project, based on what I understand, and so we just ask people to bear with us. It's an improvement that we need, both for pedestrian and for cars.
Another serious issue is body cameras for police officers. Can you very quickly, we're about out of time, where are we on that in the county?
So it's my expectation we'll be getting the county executive, Angela Alsobrook's budget, the middle of March. It's based on my initial conversations, the funding will be in there for the body cameras so we can address that issue, which I know is a serious issue. It is a substantial issue as far as funding. I was just reading that there's a state legislation to create a task force to talk about storage and trying to make it more cost effective for local governments to be able to afford the work that's important with respect to that.
Todd Turner is the chair of the Prince George's County Council and represents District 4. He's a Democrat. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you again for the invitation.
Tom Sherwood, you and I are going to be busy next Thursday evening on March 3rd. What will we be doing? March 5th. What will we be doing?
We're going to do a forum for the Ward 2 council race in the district to replace Jack Evans. Jack Evans is running. He resigned on some ethics issues, but he's running. So we'll have all the candidates with the DuPont Circle and Logan Circle Citizen Associations at the Foundry Methodist Church. It's already oversubscribed. 300 people have already taken it up. I've asked them to move it to the full sanctuary at Foundry and put out a collection plate in back so that we'll get more people in. And you're joining us to have a good forum on the candidates who want to be the new council member for Ward 2, which is the heart of the district.
And I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Today's show was produced by Sidney Grannon. Coming up on Monday, Tacoma Park is looking to set a precedent and ban all fossil fuel sales in the city by 2045. What does that mean for the people who live and do business there? Plus, D.C. has been making strides toward clean, maybe even swimmable rivers, but how much of a setback are the hundreds of millions of gallons of sewage dumped into the Potomac each year? That all starts at noon on Monday. Until then, have a wonderful weekend. What are your plans, Sherwood?
I've got to pay attention to that Super Tuesday in South Carolina presidential voting.
Have a wonderful weekend. I'm Kojo Nahamdi.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Nahamdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.